can't always be trusted. So, for the audio recording, this is Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care, Module 8, the wrap-up discussion, so therefore the wrap-up discussion for the whole course. So, of course, I forgot to turn on the audio, sorry about that. But I will have one more, as was suggested before. I'll have another wrap party audio session. Maybe not next Friday, because I don't know if I'll finish by next Friday. next Friday is the 17th, but no later than December 20th. So either the 17th or the 20th, but probably the 20th, given that I won't be working this weekend.
And that'll give me some time to catch up.
Yeah, it'll give me time to catch up. So... yeah, and I'm pretty comfortable. I got tons of notes on what I want to do for that last module. So I'm pretty comfortable it'll all come together. And it's, you know, it's all stuff I've been thinking about for quite a while. So I know what I want to say, but I actually have to say it. So what do you think? Can we become a more ethical society, or are we doomed to have AI that's only as ethical as we are? There's a question for you.
I'm feeling doomed.
You're feeling doomed.
It's theoretically possible, but history is not in our favor. Hmm. The history of human nature, whatever you want to call it, is not in our favor.
And I've been specifically looking at the last 50 years in the United States. Mm-hmm. I guess it should expand it to 60. You can pick your starting point. Kennedy assassination, Nixon resignation,
yeah.
Gold standard, invention of the internet. It doesn't matter. Pick a point.
Yeah.
And ever since then, in the United States, we have been headed in the direction we're heading, which is not good. I mean, it looks like we're headed to one party rule for what, for a generation? So when you add AI and the way it amplifies and marginalizes.
What about, yeah, I'm not doing all that. Here's a different look. Maybe we're just wrong about what's ethical. I mean, we think we have a handle on it, or at least I think I have a handle on it. You know, treating people nice, fairness, rights, whatever, that whole combination of things. Maybe we just have the wrong idea about this.
Just let the powerful exercise their power unfettered?
That seems to be the alternative. A war of all against all.
Well, not all against all. I mean, it's the powerful. They'll probably fight against each other and drag us into their conflict. But, you know, there are certainly people throughout history who've thought that, you know, that's the way things are supposed to be. Always have been, always will be. You know, maybe that's the ethical standard we can attain as humans. And you know, it's foolish to think that we can do better. It's foolish to think that the things that we postulate as better are actually better. I'm not really sure I agree with that. But I mean, the facts are on the ground, right? If better were actually better, wouldn't we do that?
Well, you could make the case that better has been modeled for short periods. And again, you can pick whatever you like. You know, recent Scandinavian political history, you know, the post-World War II era in the United States, but that only lasted 25 years.
Yeah, and ethically it wasn't really very good.
No, that's true. I mean, it had the obvious problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, perhaps the best possible outcome is the, like, your hour and a half video. Just hour and a half, those two videos, you put them together. I got to say how much I enjoyed those.
Oh, good.
Because they were so reinforcing of my experience. Hmm. Trying to do things above my, you know, capabilities or technical knowledge. And oh, perhaps, yeah. Perhaps that is the actual state. That is just this muddling that that we do as humans. But again, it seems to me the AI is going to only amplify and marginalize experience, or limit experiences, it seems to me, through this amplification.
I think, and, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead, keep going.
Well, and, you know, then it's just up to whoever owns the AI. So there you go, back to the panel.
I think it's true, to draw on a point that you made, that whatever we do, the experience is going to be one of muddling through. And yeah, I mean, those videos are part of a longer series called Stephen Follows Instructions, which is exactly what you might expect from the title. I find various things on the internet telling you how to do this or that. In this case, it was how to install and use TensorFlow. And I try to do them. And I'm a pretty educated person with a lot of experience in technology, so these things should be fine, right? And they almost never are. Far more of my following instructions have ended up in complete failure than success. And that may be the experience for most people for most of these things, and certainly the experience for society as a whole. And maybe that's what our future is, muddling through. And maybe that's what counts as ethical, the ability to muddle through without principles, without software that works, you know, without a properly functioning democracy, with indifferent application of rights, with legal systems that preferentially treat one group rather than another. Maybe that's the norm. And ethics has to occur in a background, right? There's no such thing, I think, as ethics without a context. Maybe that's what our ethics have to be designed for, insofar as we design them at all. So it's an ethics of muddling.
Yeah, it would certainly be muddling if we have to create a set of ethics for each context. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what we do. We assume we have these lists or we have these principles, but we always modify them for the context. Yeah. So how different is that from creating them on the fly?
Yeah. And these principles are like those instructions that I try to follow. I try to follow them, but something always breaks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen, in terms of AI, would you say that China is developing AI applications faster or at the same rate as, I don't know, the US, Western?
I'm going to go with the same rate.
Same rate?
Yeah. Okay. And my reasoning for that is that the development of AI is a global enterprise.
Okay.
You know, especially in the deep research side of it. Okay. You know, the advanced algorithms and all of that. You can't really work on that as a nation in isolation. It takes everybody to build these and test these applications. At least that's what I've been seeing. Now the Chinese are very good. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, and you know, for every GPT-3 we create on this side of the world, they've got something equivalent there. And you know, and no doubt Facebook has one too, and et cetera, you know.
That's true. Throw that in. Yeah. It's not even countries or political blocks. It's giant tech. Right. Okay. Yeah. The reason why I'm asking that.
Higher education.
Yeah.
Huh?
Let's not leave out higher education.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mathematicians. They are right in there with the corporations and the nations.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. The reason why I'm asking is I'm thinking of, oh, some of the things like the social contracts that are happening in China, and wondering in terms of that culture, and if culture, you know, really informs ethics.
Oh.
What happens when, you know, you have that kind of thing happening with AI behind it?
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the ethics of AI really being dependent on culture, that could come out as really different than, let's say, I don't know, AI in Russia or, you know. So what about that? Do you have warring ethics systems? I mean, you do already, really, but...
We do already, but I mean, that's a really good observation, and you know, part of that observation is why I raise questions about, you know, are we sure that we have the ethics thing solved on our side, right? Are we sure that we've picked the right model? The model here that we have tends toward competition, tends toward independent agencies such as universities or companies. China has just gone through a round of retrenchment, in the sense that some of these companies were getting very large and very powerful, including AI companies and search companies, and the Chinese government said, whoa, wait a minute, you're going to have to put this on pause for a bit. The social harms are too great, and they actually named those social harms when they said, you know, like for example, educational services, which are sometimes use AI for you know, programmed learning or content recommendation, etc. And China said these companies all have to stop operating for children under the age of 18. You just have to stop doing this. And the reason for that was it was creating an educational environment where, you know, it was too high stress, too competitive focused. It was becoming really difficult for children to lead something like a reasonably happy life when their world was, you know, in this environment of learn, cram, study, test, learn, cram, study, test. And it was just unhealthy. But the companies were all promoting this. So China said stop. Now, in the Western world, this was viewed as an overreach by the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the European General Data Protection Regulations, similar sort of motivations. It's not an AI regulation specifically, although it certainly has implications. And again, in North America, the European GDPR was viewed as an overreach. You know, government interference in the marketplace. But it's not clear that either the Chinese government or the European Commission were wrong with these measures. It's certainly not clear to me, anyways. You know, admittedly, the Chinese approach is undemocratic. I mean, nobody voted for this. Well, even that's not quite true. I mean, Xi Jinping does have to be elected to his position. It's an interesting and unusual kind of election, and it's not, you know, one where everybody across the country votes. But the delegates to the National Congress vote, and he has to be re-elected every 5 years. It's interesting how that gets represented, right? Because recently China repealed term limits, mm-hmm. right? And the reaction in the Western world was, oh, he's president for life now, but not if he has to be elected every 5 years. So, you know, there's this perception thing too. On the other hand, Hong Kong, on the other hand, Uyghurs, you know, and, but I mean, that's nothing we haven't done either. I mean, look at how we've treated indigenous people in Canada, and you see a direct parallel.
Yeah.
You know, the best I can tell China is don't repeat the mistakes that we've made. Because, you know, you're still we're still dealing with them many years later. I mean, but yeah, I mean, culture does have this clear impact on ethics. It reminds me of something I said, like I said, I did this big blockchain interview before this, and it was with respect to blockchain standards. And blockchain's this whole other area, but virtually everything we've been talking about, the ethics of AI, could also be applied to blockchain, which I find interesting. And one of the things they were talking about, standards and standards bodies and regulations and certifications, etc. And I pointed out that it costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time to participate in standards agencies. And as a result, the people who create these standards, whether they're blockchain or learning object metadata or whatever, tend to be either representatives of large corporations or representatives of interested governments, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. And large chunks of the world are not brought into the discussion. And that makes me think, you know, when we talk about ethics being cultural and the ethics of AI being culturally determined, there are many cultures who don't get to participate in that picture. And we talk about China because China is participating, and their culture, their current culture, certainly has an influence. But what about Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, or you know, Middle East, North Africa, which is a separate, very important culture, which mostly gets overlooked when we talk about AI, or South America even, you know. So, yeah, you know, AI, what counts as, or ethics, what counts as ethics is cultural, but not all cultures are equal. Mm-hmm. But that has nothing to do with ethics. That has everything to do with wealth and power. And, you know, if we look at the evidence on the ground, we're fine with that, right? You know, we're okay, you know, we're all representatives of rich cultures. We're okay with it being us who defines what counts as ethical.
That's what, yeah, when you talk about cultures defining ethics, mm-hmm. and then wealth and power, at this point, mm-hmm. the wealthy and the powerful are restrained somewhat by the parameters of that society's ethics. Mm-hmm. Now, it may not stay there, but that's happening in China as well.
Yeah,
that what happens there is reflective of a much more collectivist society. Mm-hmm. The acceptance of things like social scores and things like, yeah. that. And in talking about, you know, is China ahead? I couldn't have answered it the way Stephen did. I don't have that information, but it seems to me that the Chinese are, I don't want to say less devious, less, they're more out there with the applications of these things. Like they're doing things that would not fly in the US or Canada or Western Europe. As far as, you know, the way they have AI implemented, you one of the things that shows up on Twitter from time to time is when you jaywalk, you get an immediate ticket to your phone because of the facial recognition at the crosswalks. That type of thing is very blatantly out there, and apparently it's somewhat acceptable to the society. Now, it cuts against my rugged individualism type of thing that I was raised with, but I can see that there are different way, different worldviews that shape the values that people hold that then shape the ethics or the violation of ethics that they're willing to accept.
Yeah. Crossing the street's a great example. There's a red light, yet we choose to cross the street. And the question is, well, what makes us so special? Yeah.
No cars coming.
Yeah. So maybe it would be desirable to have a more sensitive red light system that can tell when there's no cars coming. But, I mean, you know, we seem to think that it's okay to break a rule if we can think of a good reason why we're breaking the rule. No cars coming. We really don't like it when rich people do that, but they do that all the time. So, you know, our attitudes about rule breaking, we can see how the Chinese might think about this, particularly, you know, in light of the fact that, you know, throughout history, so many people have lived with this basic disregard for the rules, that over time it becomes, you know, a symptom of, you know, deeper problems. If people don't follow the rules, what happens next? You know, if Donald Trump doesn't follow the rules of being a president and ignores court judgments and subpoenas and all of that, well, then what follows from that? So, yeah, that makes sense to me. Then again, I'm not really a rule follower.
Yeah. There it is.
Yeah, there it is.
We definitely want to decide which rules to follow based on, do these rules make sense or not to me?
I think that's part of it. I think it's to me.
Yeah.
And you know, you're right, Jim, that China has a much more collectivist perspective. And that's just ingrained. It's part of society. You don't look at just yourself. You look at you and your family and your neighbors, and it has to be okay with the collective.
Yeah.
Right? And the collective, you don't want to harm that collective. Right? It's a different way of looking at things. I had a student a couple of years ago who was from China, and I think she probably will go back. And that was her discussion with me in terms of what's good for the most of people is what you follow, not what is good for me, right? And she really described that very well in terms of China and people following the rules.
Yeah.
What's wrong with a social contract? It'll make the most people secure and happy. So what if one person, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think that's a really important cultural difference.
As you're speaking... Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm trying to remember the name of the Canadian, I think he was a political scientist, but he might have been a philosopher, that gave a famous series of lectures that was collected in the book. I can't find it on Google. Who compared Western democracy to Chinese democracy, and made the case that the Chinese are more democratic because their system works for more of the people. And I just think he was a Mac, like, so, or was it the lecture series was McMaster? But anyway, I can't find it. It was a mid-century. Mid-20th century. Yeah. Very famous. I learned about it in a political science class. I just cannot come up with his name.
It's probably the Massey Lectures is the lecture series, would be my guess. That's it. Yeah.
There you are. And it's not Charles Taylor. It was somebody before him.
Okay.
But in that area. And he made a very good case about the China. And again, that was during the Cultural Revolution or just after it.
Yeah.
And he was making the, you know, logical argument that they were in fact more democratic because they were concerned with the greater good, unlike us and our individualism. But again, I don't like to follow the rules either. Just for an example, I just crossed an intersection that has stoplights and the buttons you push and the beeping and the voice and all that. That I learned to cross when I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
Same intersection. But it didn't have all that back then.
Yeah.
And I was I was well trained, and I crossed that intersection daily for years without incident.
Yeah.
And now I would reduce my social capital if I was photographed, recognized, or looking both ways, seeing no traffic. Yeah. Anywhere and walking across the street. So I have a problem with that. I'm all for the greater good, but on the other hand, I'm also for individual responsibility, personal responsibility.
Sure you do.
No, I was just going to say that's ingrained in us.
Mm-hmm.
We are very individualistic. And we'll always look at, you know, what's in it for me.
Well, I would frame it a different way. I would frame it, I'm pretty well aware of where obedience can lead. And now we can say...
Where what? Sorry, Mark?
Where obedience leads. Can. So I frame it differently. Yeah. I don't frame it like, oh, I know better than everybody else. I frame it that obedience has some potential problems. But so far, since the Cultural Revolution, China hasn't invaded anywhere. China doesn't have troops all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so again, the case can be made that they're doing a better job of working for the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
And now with their, Belt and Road?
Belt and Road Initiative,
Belt and Road. With their initiative, rather than... imitating or whatever, carrying on the Western tradition of colonization, they seem to be putting resources into local cultures in good faith because they're saying what they want right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. They're not coming in with missionaries and lying and stealing resources or whatever. They're just straight up saying, look, we'll give you a system of trains if you let us do this mining or whatever, in this contractual arrangements. That's my impression of what's going on. Doesn't seem very nefarious to me. And the colonizers sure didn't leave behind the system of hospitals and public transportation and infrastructure and all that. So here we are 150, 200 years later, the same cultures still need those basic things, and the Chinese are providing them.
Now, it's interesting to reflect on the fact that India was pretty much the wealthiest part of the world before the British arrived, the Europeans in general, and the British in particular, and left it a basket case, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This probably shouldn't call India a basket case, but I mean, certainly left it as not the richest area of the world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And The argument is, and maybe that's the wrong approach to take, even to argue it at all, but the argument is that democracy and individual rights produce better results for the majority. This idea that as John Stuart Mill would say, each person pursuing their own good in their own way produces a diversity of alternatives. And then if you have something like, a marketplace of ideas, along Adam Smith kind of lines, then the best ideas will rise to the top. That's the argument. And, you look at the successes of the Western nations, and there is an argument to be made for that. I have trouble sometimes because the cost of that, I mean, we talk about the cost in China of individual rights and the cost in the Western world is that people live in poverty. Mm-hmm. People die not able to afford health care. People can't afford housing. The incidence of drug addiction, the incidence of crime. China is a much safer country than the United States. It's not even comparable. The U.S. has the largest number of prisoners in the world. It's six of one, half dozen of the other. I'm not going to say China is perfect. I'm not going to say Saudi Arabia is perfect, although Saudi Arabia is also very safe. The movie, what was it called? The Kingdom, notwithstanding. I mean, I've walked around Riyadh, a big white Western infidel. I just walked freely around the streets, no problem. So Riyadh is safe. Saudi Arabia is safe. It's again, the culture is different. I walked around in Côte d'Ivoire, Abidjan, and there are places I'd feel pretty nervous, but mostly because my kind of people have a history of exploiting their kind of people, and there's some resentment about that. But again, I walked around Abidjan in various areas, not just in the city center known as Plateau, but in a bunch of other areas. And it's just people going about their own lives. Sometimes they stare at you, but you got to expect that. So it's hard to say that our way is the best way. There's almost any cultural approach, any cultural ethics seems to have winners and losers. And it seems to me that overall that's a bad idea. But again, evidence on the ground is people are prepared to accept that in pursuit of some other ideal. Boy, I sound cheerful today, don't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as the minority who has to just accept that isn't us.
That seems to be the tipping point. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Well, if I'm a Uyghur in China, or if I'm a Christian who's not part of the Three Self Churches in China, it's not so pleasant, but it's a small minority, and the majority doesn't affect us. I mean, here in Canada, grew up most of my life's aware of Indigenous people, but only in the last 10 or 15 years have I started learning what, even though I visited a residential school as a teenager, I had no idea until this started coming out. So our awareness, our willingness to be blind to those things is whose ethics?
And I think that's, we did the duty of care module, and I think one of the big things that comes out of that duty of care module is that when we're talking about ethics and we're talking about the technology, that we need to begin with the discussion, the perspective of, or the point of view of that minority that is going to suffer in any particular approach. So, you know, if we talk about the ethics of China, we need to begin with the Uyghurs. If we talk about the ethics of Canada, we need to begin with Indigenous people. In the U.S., Black Lives Matter, perhaps. In the Middle East, women. In Africa, gays and lesbians. In India, the untouchables. In Australia, the Aboriginals, etc.
But we have to not forget
that other minority that runs everything.
Sorry?
That's a bit. When you're speaking of minorities, mm-hmm. you're speaking of disadvantaged minorities.
Yeah.
But there's also a highly advantaged minority in most of those areas you just described.
I agree.
Make the decisions.
Yeah.
You know, and that's growing up in California. To Jim's point, I just finished a university class in intercultural communication,
mm-hmm.
and I really struggled in that class. It was out of a University of Minnesota. I'm in California, and everybody else in the class had that experience. Like, wow, we're just learning about Indigenous people and gay rights and all this, and I'm sitting here going, I grew up in Los Angeles, and my mother's from New Mexico. From my earliest days, I realized there were multiple cultures. In New Mexico, you have three distinct cultures. Mm-hmm. And they haven't been at war with each other for a long time. They kind of get along.
Yeah.
But there is a minority that runs the state. And so from early days, and luckily I had parents that moved to Los Angeles and found it interesting that there were these different people they never heard of. Yeah. And so again, as a child, we visited Jewish families and, you know, Catholic families and these different, you know, types of people that you would never meet in a small place.
Yeah.
And so I really struggled with the binary thinking, us, them, you know, they're a minority, whatever. It just doesn't come up here. Jim's got another meeting.
Yeah. Well, and I do want to wrap it up at 1 o'clock because I think it's only fair. To not just Jim, but to our viewers generally. You know, I think it's not about how many people constitute a majority or a minority. I mean, it's not even whether they are a majority or a minority. I think, you know, the essential question is, are they disadvantaged? Are they oppressed? Are they in some way less able to participate in the culture that defines what is ethical, what is right, what is good. And maybe that's the hopeful note that we can end on, that you know, ethics is something that by its nature belongs to all of us. There's no subgroup, majority or minority, that has a privileged position over it. And we recognize that when we do ask those who have the least opportunity to make their views known, when we ask them first what they would perceive as ethical, understanding that somebody who lives in a shack in Malawi with an annual income of $42 has as much a stake in the discussion of ethics as you or I or anyone on the planet, and therefore needs to be involved in that decision of what counts as ethical and what doesn't. And it's not a John Rawls social contract kind of thing, because, well, that inherently does favor the already wealthy, but, you know, because, you know, it's all about negotiations and legalisms and things like that. It's a much more messy thing, you know, the 60,000 parameters thing. But we don't get to that point unless we make sure that this person in the shack in Malawi is the first person we ask. And I think if I had to summarize my ethical position, it would be something like that. And that very much reflects the influence of the duty of care philosophy. But it also reflects, perhaps, the aspirations of the other ethical theories to maybe raise us up to be something more than what the evidence on the ground says we actually are. And that, I think, is something worthwhile.
And we'll be able to thank the Chinese for giving that person in Malawi access to the conversation.
If that's what they're doing, then more power to them.
And I certainly think that's sort of the, whatever, a spinoff or, something that comes from this, whether it's intended or not.
It's something that we should have been doing and maybe should start doing. Yes. All right, we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Again, one more kick at the Zoom cat, probably on Monday the 20th, but watch the newsletter. I'll keep the newsletter running until I'm out of videos. And we'll wrap it up really well, I hope.
Okay.
Although I did like that last few sentences, and keep those in mind. All right. See you then. Thanks a lot.